Novel Ideas Podcast.
The Novel Ideas Podcast, a podcast with two siblings who love books.
Yep.
We love them so, so much. I built a freezer out of books. It doesn't work. My meat's all spoiled now. But on the bright side, I got to read about Salmonella.
I'm not allowed to talk because women aren't allowed in this week's podcast episode.
Oh, this book has no women in it, so it's just going to be me monologuing the entire time.
I'll occasionally bitch at you.
Oh, so it'll be like a usual night hanging out, in other words.
I'll be as much like the Comdora as possible.
Just be kind of irritated and pissy until I show you something shiny.
Yeah.
Look, I got you something pretty. Oh, never mind. I'm not pissed anymore.
Close.
The fate of planets is at stake. The power balance of this sector is at stake. Oh, you got me something pretty? Okay, I don't care.
Yeah. If I've learned one thing from Isaac Asimov, it's how women truly think.
Facepalm.
Oh, dear. I know I harp on this issue. I've done it a couple of times, but honestly, we've read several male authors who are apparently allergic to female characters.
They just don't know women exist. They've never met one.
Arthur... I was called Isaac Asimov, Arthur C. Clarke. Isaac Asimov was married when he wrote this book. Maybe his wife is like the Commodore. Maybe that's why they got divorced.
Isaac C. Klasimov.
Klasimov. It's their butt baby. It's like all the other babies on Foundation.
Ister Klasimov.
Okay.
Okay, by the way, there is a spoiler policy since we've already covered a couple plot points. But it's kind of silly to read a spoiler policy, or announce one rather, in front of a book that was written in the 1950s. Just know that if you haven't read this book, we're going to talk about everything in it. So,
yes.
Bail if that's going to piss you off.
And the book we're talking about is Foundation by Isaac Asimov.
Yeah, and as this is an audio medium, I can't just show you something shiny and unpiss you off. So, here's your chance to go.
And it's not the one with robots and Will Smith. So if you're looking for that...
I know, it's so weird that Isaac Asimov was prescient enough to predict that Will Smith would someday be in movies and to write a book about Will Smith and robots.
Yeah, it was smart.
Because that's what happened.
It's totally what happened.
Because that's what actually happened.
Also, tomorrow, by the way, Will Smith is going to save the world from aliens.
Yeah, he totally is.
Yeah. Just so you know.
So look for that.
Before we get started, we just had a couple pieces of listener mail. Alan actually dropped us an IMDb link to a movie called Easy A, which came out a couple years ago, starring Emma Stone, about a high schooler who gets accused of sleeping with a guy she didn't actually, and after that moment basically starts pretending to have sex with guys at the high school to give them little reputation boosters, and they give her, like, you know, gift cards in return. And because they're reading The Scarlet Letter in her English class, she decides to start walking around with an A embroidered on all of her clothes.
Yeah, so it's not exactly a...
college comedy.
Scarlet Letter college comedy, but it is a loosely Scarlet Letter-ish high school comedy.
Yeah, it's pretty good. I've seen it. It is... amusing. So.
Well, I've heard good things just now from you.
maybe we'll watch it.
Okay.
Sometime.
On the podcast.
With our, like, other... We'll just narrate the movie. Like, oh, that's funny.
Next,
silence next, for 10 minutes.
Next episode of the podcast, the audio from Easy A with us making comments every once in a while. Not even funny ones. Not like riff tracks.
No, not like
riff
tracks. We'll just...
It's like,
oh,
it'll just be...
That guy looks like a nerd.
The audio from the movie and my natural reaction to the movie, not trying to be entertaining at all.
Sounds like a blast.
It's going to be our best
this
episode.
Actually sounds...
It ended up being our most downloaded episode.
Well, that'll have to become our new thing. Fat guy reacts to movies in a non-interesting way.
A new internet sensation.
Our new podcast.
Fat dork is boring in front of movies.
I want to live in a world where this is true.
Oh, man.
Okay.
And so, Carl wanted us to know that, though he is enjoying the podcast, that our audio production quality is not that great. We are aware of that.
I am offended. It's so good.
It is a work in progress. My deepest apologies to everybody. I know that it's quiet because, well, I'm not going to get into the technical details right now, but I know that it is coming out quiet, and then that the laughing, especially the last couple episodes, is, as Carl put it, 50 times louder than a garden planet exploding. And I have an idea of why that's happening, too. I'll get it figured out eventually, maybe in another dozen episodes.
We might get our tech brother to help us with the sound.
Yeah.
We might just make Carl come over and fix it. We're not entirely sure. So, yeah.
Yep, so if anyone has Audacity chops, then feel free to come on over.
Teach us how to equalize shit. We'll buy you, like, a candy bar.
Yeah, I know it can compress stuff. I just don't know how that works very well.
Yeah. So, moving on to Foundation, as already mentioned, Isaac Asimov, who earned a PhD in biochemistry in the 1940s.
Yes, which we had to go look up using our usual rigorous research habits, Wikipedia, because I've read other authors refer to him as Dr. Asimov, and I had always just referred to him as Dr. Asimov, but didn't actually know what he had a doctorate in, or if he actually had one at all. So it turns out, yes.
He does.
He did have a doctorate.
And he, interestingly, was almost involved in a project. Thanks, Wikipedia. He was almost involved in the atomic bomb. I was like, wow, almost. That is not even a fact about a person.
So the Manhattan Project needing a lot of biochemists / science fiction authors?
Yes.
Okay. Well, apparently not, as it turns
out. Harry Seldon!
That's right.
Drop the atomic bomb.
We need a psychohistorian.
He'd been like, nothing I can do.
What'll be the ramifications of this? Do some math. Get out your calculator and tell me what Earth will do.
I love that audio where Hari is like, okay, Gaul, this is what's going to happen. Math, 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 math. See? Wait, that can't be right. I'm like, how did he get that from a number? Let me show you if I take it this way instead. Math, 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 math. Oh, that makes sense. Now I'm embarrassed I didn't see it before. I'm sitting there like, okay.
871. The government will collapse tomorrow. Oops, I forgot to carry the... Oh, that's actually 872. Oh, okay, peace for 1,000 years. This numbers seem kind of close together for those results.
Oh, psycho historians. I do kind of like this concept that numbers can predict human action.
Well, you'll note that it is not individual actions, it is large bodies of people, statistically significant sample sizes.
Right. It's a mass prediction of, you know, what state is the United States going to be in 100 years? Not like, what am I going to eat for breakfast tomorrow? It's not astrology.
Right. That being said, there's probably someone out there who's attempted that kind of statistical analysis to some degree or another and has been completely off base, because people can't predict the future.
Well, if you watch Nicolas Cage's Knowing,
oh God,
and you look at that sheet of numbers, he predicts all of the accidents.
In two episodes, I will be watching Nicolas Cage's Knowing.
Oh my God, we totally should. You guys, you should watch it. It's fucking terrible. And then please leave me comments what you think about Knowing. I will make a Knowing comment discussion thread on the website just so we can talk about it.
Two siblings who love books and Nicolas Cage is Knowing.
No. It's so bad. It's amazing. Anywho. Ben, why don't you talk a little bit about the inspiration for the book?
Oh, sure. The inspiration for this story, or at least so the tale goes, is that a young, or at least young in his writing career, Isaac Asimov was going into a meeting with John Campbell, who's one of the major editors, especially in science fiction history, and he had to go pitch a story idea, and he's sitting out there in the lobby going, oh, shit, I don't have any story ideas. But he had been reading Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, And so he came up with a pitch for a series of stories based on the decline and fall of the Roman Empire. And thus was Foundation born. That's right. Brass fanfare here. Or whatever the Romans played. Probably not brass.
Probably.
Like horns.
Yeah. Harp things.
And drums.
Liars. Which you can actually definitely see in the book. Ben mentioned this to me before I started reading, and I actually forgot promptly before I started reading that was the foundation for Foundation.
Yes.
But while reading it, I didn't really pick up on any Latin names or specifically Roman references, but I mean, there obviously is the overarching theme and plot of an empire breaking apart and yes. going into chaos, which is
massive empire breaking apart at the fringes, regions reverting to barbarism.
It's some second century Rome shit right there.
Yeah.
So, you can definitely see the parallel. We chose the book because Isaac Asimov is one of the big names in science fiction. As I already mentioned, he wrote robot books as well. And I'm pretty sure his rules for robots are like yes, the standard...
The famous three laws of robotics are from Isaac Asimov.
Uh-huh. People follow those too. Like, that's a thing.
No, it's definitely become a thing, yeah. It's still, it gets referenced to some degree or another, and I feel like almost everything I've ever read that involves robots.
Or AI.
I could even tell you what the rules are, but no one cares, so let's continue.
Oh, I kind of care.
I'll tell you off the air.
Okay, I'll talk about the Turing test.
Well, if we read a robot book of his later, we can talk about that then.
Okay.
All right.
So, genre is obviously science fiction. Wait, like
it is? I thought it was historical fiction.
You're an idiot.
Man, I thought it was historical fiction the whole time.
This book takes place so far in the future that they don't even know what Earth is anymore.
Yes, humanity dominates the galaxy. We have covered the entire galaxy. We know every single star. And no one knows where we came from anymore.
Yeah.
Let's see. Well, the figure 12,000 years was thrown out there.
Yes.
But I think that's how long the Empire's been around.
Yes.
So I'm going to guess that people have been off of Earth for probably twice that long.
Probably. So this is, you know, at least 12,000 years in the future. Possibly 24,000 years in the future.
This is what we call far future science fiction.
Yeah. It's... I did like how when they... swore to something instead of saying, like, oh my god, they'd go, spaceman.
Yeah. Galaxy.
Or later on, Selden.
There are some advantages to writing far future science fiction. You don't even have to attempt to make any predictions based on things you think will actually happen.
Yeah.
You can just create a whole new setting and say, there it is, what happened? Well, I don't know, there are several millennia in between, so you make it up.
Mm-hmm. The technology's advanced, super advanced, way more than what we have, but it's so far in the future, who cares?
Right, like, technology could have risen and fallen 17 times between now and then.
Yeah. Which, you know, well, I guess to us, you know, if technology falls and you're in space, that sounds weird, like, kind of weirdly impossible, but a lot of them are just grounded on their new planets, so it is possible to have the technology to get to the new planet and then lose all the technology that got you there.
Yeah, I thought some of the technological mentions in there were really interesting, because you'd have these four kingdoms that used to be part of the Empire, and they still have interstellar space travel.
Uh-huh.
They still have hyperspace motors, mm-hmm. but they're getting their residential and commercial power planet side through gas, oil, and coal.
Yeah.
So, wow, there's a divide there.
How did they do that? Because one of the things that's so great about Foundation, or this, you know, group on Terminus, is that they can provide everyone with atomic power. This lost technology.
That's right. Most of the folks have heard of it or only have it in the form of gigantic atomic reactors that power an entire city, but, you know, no little atomic gadgets or
Clark totally predicted computers, by the way. Like, the 1970s, like, the huge computer that barely fits in a room. And in 2012, like, your tiny little phone that Google searches a billion times faster than that 1970s computer that built in the
giant. Your phone, your tiny little phone that has more computing power than 10 of the Apollo mission computers.
Yeah, what was that fact about the Apollo spaceship?
I can't tell you what the number is, but a TI-82 graphing calculator actually has more processing power than the Apollo 11 moon mission did.
What the hell? I mean, I guess that makes it more plausible that they have computing, or that they have space travel and not high technology, because can you imagine your TI-82 graphing calculator taking you to the moon? Like, what the fuck?
Yeah, I need to calculate how to get back to Earth. Wait, all I have is this?
I have a pencil and a piece of paper. That's what the astronauts had.
And a window.
Yeah. Like, I mean, I guess this is movie-dropping episode, but if you've ever seen Apollo 13, when basically they have to shut everything down, I'm like, okay, guys, we have to do a burn, so this is what you're gonna do. Look out the window, and make sure you can see Earth the entire time. Like, oh, wow, that's real specific. Like, thanks, guys.
We're all gonna die. Aren't we? By the way, tune in 3 weeks for Ben Watches Apollo 13.
I'll just be crying the entire time, by the way. Apollo 13, like, ruins me forever for everything. Alright. I guess we never gave a plot synopsis.
We've
just been, like, randomly talking.
I know, we're all over the place.
Oh, Lord.
What is our plot synopsis this week?
Well, we kind of had a hard time with the plot synopsis, and I wrote this down because I thought it was funny. Ben said it was hard because the story is episodic to the max. Because really we have four distinct plot lines going on, and even within those plot lines, there's a lot of different stuff happening. So it's kind of hard to sum it all up into a...
Yeah, there are five parts to the book. There are four different protagonists within those parts. There are probably seven or eight distinct episodes within those five parts. It is very episodic.
Mm-hmm. But what we came up with is, science is my religion. Also, I'm better than you.
Yeah. That's what I honestly believe. No, wait, that's what the characters all come across as. they're all the characters, the protagonists, because there's no one protagonist in this story. I'll come across as being just a little bit smarter, just a little bit better than the people around them.
One of the ways I saw it is that each plot line where they reach some kind of big crisis or confrontation always ends with the protagonist at the time being like, oh, sleight of hand, I win.
It's the one guy who really understands the historical forces that are in play.
Uh-huh.
And he's the one who says, well, how about instead of doing everything, we do nothing? Hey, it worked!
Hey!
Score one for the foundation. Why don't we just get into these characters?
Okay.
So the very first segment is before the foundation is even established. It's with a late and aged Harry Seldon, and he's technically not the protagonist of this segment, but by about the midpoint of it, he really is.
Yeah, and I mean, he's the only character that's a driving force through the entire book.
Right, because he's the one who founded the science of psychohistory and founded the foundation.
And basically created all this, or put the pieces in place so that all this stuff could happen.
Right.
So, yeah. But we have Harry Seldon, the creator of psychohistory, which Ben and I were saying earlier, is basically a branch of science where you plug in numbers and apply it to the way human beings and cultures move and grow and predict it.
Yeah, and so, like, think of, like, particle physics, where you just have all these individual bodies bouncing off each other, you can calculate probabilities based on what we know about the properties of these things. He's basically taking that idea and applying it to people.
Yeah.
So it's probability-based. It's, oh, well, it's a 98% chance that this is going to happen within X period of time.
Yeah, he at 50 years in after he's dead and he appears again to the colonists on Foundation, and he says, well, there's a 98% chance that you'll be seeing me again, so I'll just keep on talking. His deal is that he's created a lot of problems on the planet Trantor, or Trantor, however you say it, because he's predicted that within the next 500 years, it's basically going to collapse on itself, and the entire empire, this is part of a galactic empire, hundreds, thousands of planets. I think they said a quadrillion people are living in the empire.
A quadrillion souls. That's a fuckload of people.
Yeah. he predicts the empire is going to get plunged into chaos for 30,000 years.
That's a long time.
That's a really long time. That's basically longer than human recorded history at the moment.
Yeah, that's actually about as long as what are recognizably modern humans have been around.
Yeah. So, anyone who believes in the lost city of Atlantis, that one's the you.
That's right.
Their technology was lost to us. But he says that he can reduce this 30,000 year period to 1,000 years if they just let him and all of his researchers write an encyclopedia. Guys?
And the aristocracy's response to that is, oh, we can take all the potentially rebellious kooks and toss them to the edge of the galaxy and they're just gonna make a book. See ya!
Awesome.
Have fun.
And Selden's argument is that if they record all of the science, the history, everything that's going on, then when the Empire does fall apart, they can just apply everything that they've recorded, and they won't lose the information like they would
otherwise. Yeah, he puts it in the context of preserving the knowledge.
Yes. It actually reminded me of Middle Ages. A lot of the Greek and Roman texts that we have today are because of the Muslims. When the Western world, for lack of a better term, was pissing its pants, basically fighting each other constantly without end, and had lost, like, all of the technology ancient cultures had. The Muslims were growing and expanding and finding all these texts, and all the Muslim philosophers were like, oh, maybe these will be interesting and important. So they copied them all down, and then when the West kind of got a hold of themselves again and managed to expand far enough to hit Muslim cities, they went, oh, you guys have, like, all these books we don't have. We just have, like, 100 books by Thomas Aquinas. That's, like, all we have. That's the entire scope of our literature. And they're like, can we look at some of that? And that's the reason for the Renaissance, is the Muslims giving us classic works. So,
oh, snap.
Yeah. Just like to point that out to everyone. You better go hug a Muslim tomorrow.
That's right. Let's put the Muslims into historical context here.
But that reminded me, that mission to put together this massive encyclopedia reminded me a lot of that. Let's preserve all the information so that, you know, the Empire can kind of go through this renaissance instead of just fighting endless wars against each other and, you know, being 99% peasants.
Yes, let's have a middle class. That's basically how you define prosperity, right?
Yeah.
Having a middle class.
Kinda, yeah.
A sizable middle class. So, you know, it's actually a fairly short section. And so it takes us to the Foundation itself. Fast forward 50 years.
Bam.
And we are now following Salvor Hardin.
Salvor Hardin, whose name I can never remember.
But is easily the most interesting character in the book.
Yes. He has the, in my opinion, he has the most fun plot points, and he is the most memorable character. Harry Selden, for all his, like, awesome setting everything up, is not like a very deep character.
He only gets 10 pages.
We don't know anything about him. And the main guy after Hardin is interesting, but again, like, not that developed beyond a couple of characteristics, since he's kind of, you know, in it for the money aspect. He's kind of typical, what's the word I'm looking for?
Merchant type.
Yeah.
Maybe even past that, like, salesman type, definitely.
Yeah.
The traders, they're all about making their profits.
Mm-hmm.
That is, it's the bottom line and nothing else for those guys. And so even when they're performing a mission on behalf of the state, or sort of on behalf of the state, they're still looking to make a few bucks out of it.
So that was the thing I liked about Hardin's character and plot as a contrast, is he's the first one to figure out what the heck Selden means and what he needs to do.
Yep.
And, like, the way he pulls all of his trickery is actually for the good of the Foundation moving forward, so.
Right, yeah. The planet that they've been given, Terminus, has nothing going for it whatsoever.
Yeah. No metals.
Yeah, no heavy metals, no really resources. I mean, arable farmland, that's about what they have.
Mm-hmm.
And so they are very reliant upon trade, and one of the reasons that they become such a center of technology is because efficiency is so important to them. They're all about miniaturization and taking things that used to be huge and took tons of metal and making one that'll fit in your pocket.
Yeah, the explanation is, you know, they don't have any precious metals or heavy metals. You know, they value iron, okay, or steel. So why would they waste 20 times the steel that they need to build this tiny little version of something? It's way more practical if they, you know, have to spend X amount on steel to
right.
use it as efficiently as possible.
I don't need a computer the size of a room. I have it in my palm.
Yeah.
I don't need an atomic reactor the size of a building. I have one the size of a walnut, which I'm not sure is actually feasible. But
no, probably not. But it's 12,000 years in the future.
That's right. Like, who knows? At least. Who knows what they figured out by then?
Whereas the Empire is put on this contrast of being on, not only are they on the grand scale of having all these planets and people under their power, but they've just learned how to build grand pieces of technology, right?
Oh, yeah, everything is huge. There's a plot line where they find a derelict ship from the Empire and rebuild it for one of the kingdoms, and this thing is so huge it doubles the cubic capacity of that kingdom's entire space fleet with one ship. Because it's just massive. It's miles long.
And it's, or when, at the very beginning, we have Gaul showing up on Trantor, and they basically all live under, like, a 2-mile-tall bubble thing.
Yeah, the whole planet's domed in, 40 billion people living there, which is actually a small population for a planet that's entirely domed in and has no oceans.
Yeah.
And, like, 4 agricultural worlds that are devoted entirely to feeding the capital of the Empire.
Uh-huh.
And just thousands of barges landing every day and dropping off food, presumably.
Yeah, so these guys are big. They're on the like operatic scale.
Oh yeah, like they could lose a whole planet and they wouldn't even notice.
And they in fact do lose an entire planet and don't even notice.
They lose the entire periphery of the Empire and barely even notice.
Yeah, they don't really care that
they much. Acknowledge it happened, but that's about as far as they go.
Yeah.
So Hardin is your classic outsmart the opposition type of character.
Mm-hmm.
And it finds ways to parlay the Foundation's strengths into a position of domination over their neighbors, which takes some doing because they have no political or military power whatsoever.
Yeah, and the cool thing about this section is that it's not who has more military spending or more military, I don't know, ships. It's they have technology, and so they basically managed to kind of wrangle in these other kingdoms around them to follow what they're saying by agreeing to give them atomic technology that they've lost. And so it's all about the smarts, but my favorite part of it is that, you know, they don't want to make more scientists who can make more atomic energy, because then they'll compromise themselves, right? You don't want to put yourself back in the same position you were.
Well, yeah, if you give them all the same stuff you have, then once they have that stuff, they're just going to come back and conquer you.
Exactly. So they give them the atomic power, but then the only people who know how to run it are priests.
Yeah, they set up the science. They set up their science in all of these client countries, nations, as a religion. It's like, oh, the great spirit of the galaxy will bring power to our ships and to our cities, and they have they're able to sell it very effectively because they can perform miracles because they have all these little bits of technology that none of these people have ever seen before.
Yeah, so. The priests all know how to run the technology. None of them know how to fix it or build it or anything.
Right.
And I liked that example of when they crowned the new king on Anacreon and they put him in his little, like, atomic throne and have him fly around a little bit and everyone would be, ooh, he's godlike.
Right.
And that's actually, there's some quote out there saying somewhere, like, once technology gets to a certain point, it starts looking like magic.
Yes, I can't remember who said it first either, but any sufficiently advanced technology, is it indistinguishable from magic or something along those lines?
And if you just plucked someone out of 1500, let's say, plopped them in today's world, I mean, assuming that they, you know, forgetting all the other complications that caused, I mean, they would look at your laptop or your television or your car and just be like, what?
And just start shouting, witch!
Like, like, what is this? That's impossible! That is magic! Because, like, that shit's crazy.
Right, yeah.
The other parallel about this setting up science as a religion thing that I really liked...
the sound of sunglasses falling.
I dropped the sunglasses. The other thing I liked about it is I had a professor once who was talking to us about, we were studying evangelicalism, is that the correct word? Evangelism, there you go, in the Old South before the Civil War. And we were talking about some of the things that they believed and followed, and a couple people in the class were kind of snickering, like, those people were stupid for believing that. And so our teacher is going, okay, you know, let's put this into some perspective. Do any of you believe in the Big Bang? And everyone's like, yeah, pretty much all of us accept the Big Bang theory, okay? And he goes, do any of you know exactly why scientists believe in the Big Bang, or the reasoning behind it, or the study or research, or anything behind it besides just it happened? And everyone's like, no. He said, okay, so you're just accepting on faith that scientists are probably right about the Big Bang, even though you can't prove it. And we're all like, yeah. So in a way, to the modern day person, science is almost a form of religion.
And you can kind of see where it might be coming from. I like to think there are a few differences, but that's mostly chauvinism on my part, I think.
I mean, there definitely are differences, but the main point that I like is, you know...
Right, you yourself still can't prove any of it.
Exactly. When I went to the evolution exhibit in Chicago, my mind was getting blown every 10 seconds because I had believed in evolution. Uh-oh, I just lost 10 listeners. but I had never known exactly all the little stuff that led scientists to believe that it worked. Like, I knew some of it, you know? And learning, oh, here's, like, the cellular level, and here's this and this and this, and all of a sudden I was like, whoa, this makes so much sense. Like, evolution makes, like, 100 times more sense now that I've learned how they came up with the theory of it. And so there's definitely the difference in that. You can dig into science and start, like, getting more and more and more of it. Whereas with faith, you don't actually have the scientific formula at the beginning of it that points to it, right? Which is why we have to debate the existence of God and we don't have to debate other scientific things.
Right, because the purpose of faith is that you don't have to have evidence.
Mm-hmm.
But here's a religion where you can have evidence.
Yeah.
So that makes it an easy sell. How about we hit our last character here?
Okay.
Well, actually, there are technically two. There's a guy named Limar Ponyets, who's a traitor.
I don't even care about him.
Who, honestly, is not very memorable, nor is his plot line. All right, and so then we have Hober Mallow, who is the first merchant prince. He's also a traitor. He's just better at it.
Marshmallow. That's how I remember his name.
Yeah, he's a sweetie. No, wait, he's not.
Oh, wait, he's not at all.
Not at all. He is a kind of a cutthroat, actually, if anything. But he's the next Salver Hardin type of character. He guides the Foundation through their next big crisis. And actually, I really like the way that he does it, because he guides them through it by doing absolutely nothing.
Well, I mean, he kind of does something by doing nothing.
Right. They sell a bunch of gadgets to Coral. Corel?
Something like that.
And they do it without using religion to pull them into the fold.
Yeah, so typically before, when all the science had been presented as, this has to work with a priest.
Right.
Mallow's sell is, look, you can work this with no priest.
Yeah. Hey, we have gadgets. You can work it yourself. Flip a switch. Here's a how-to manual. You need a new one. You give your buddy Hober Mallow a call, and he'll set you up with one.
Yep.
And, you know, I'll sell you 1,000 of these at 1,000 credits apiece, and then you can resell them at 10,000 credits apiece, and everybody's happy. So, yeah, when they go to war, his solution is, oh, okay, well, I guess we're not selling them stuff anymore.
Yeah.
And we'll just wait for the people of Coral to get pissed off because none of their creature comforts exist anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And they're fighting a war of conquest, and they're going to get antsy.
Yep. It's when someone makes the comment of, well, you know, in a time of war, people will go out without everything. He's like, yeah, but there's never actually going to be fighting, so people won't be willing to sacrifice all that stuff. Because they want their stuff.
Yeah, man, give me my stuff. And I actually thought that his sell for why they can sit back and not do anything is a little bit like Lysistrata. It's one of Gabrielle's favorite references.
I do enjoy that play. The plot of Lysistrata is essentially ancient Greek cities warring with each other for too long of a time for a reason no one really remembers. The women of the city go, this is bullshit, we are sick of this. So they get together and they decide no sex for any of their husbands until they stop fighting. And what do you know, the war ends like a week later.
And so here in Foundation, Hober is saying, well, you know, what's going to happen when the wife can't clean her clothes in her atomic clothes cleaner? Because apparently you need atomic power to do that.
Apparently.
And her dishwasher and her shiny, sparkly, atomic-powered baubles that make her look pretty. She's going to get pissed.
Yep.
And then he didn't say this, but I add this part in myself. And then you're not getting any. And then you're not going to war anymore. Because it's stupid. And then we'll win. The end. Love, Hober Mallow.
Love. Just write that letter. You will not get any love, Hober Mallow. Like, if someone said, like, TLDR, like, you sum up his entire speech with, you're not getting any.
You're not getting any.
I really like that reasoning, too. The thing I don't think quite works with the Lysistrata parallel is that Lysistrata actually has female characters in it.
Okay, so let's get down to some of our issues.
And Foundation has no female characters!
So we definitely referenced this heavily in the opening.
There is... Okay, I think there are two female characters in the entire book.
One of them gets dialogue.
One of them gets... I think the other one gets to say, ooh.
Yeah,
when they put, like, the atomic cloak on her.
Yeah, right. Which, by the way, sounds really badass when you call an atomic cloak.
Yeah, it doesn't.
It's like a belt. You flip a switch and it covers you in sparklies.
Yeah, basically.
It actually made me think Hunger Games just a little bit.
Oh, yeah. I was actually kind of thinking Joseph in the Technicolor.
Like, gaudier.
Not so much like the classy thing.
You flip the switch and you're covered in flames. You look badass.
Katniss.
Who wouldn't want that?
Katniss.
It was described, it was described in the book as if you shaped clothing out of an aurora borealis.
Yeah, yeah. That was cool. I mean, that probably would look pretty badass.
That'd probably be pretty cool.
But, they put it on the servant girl. She basically says, ooh. And then you get maybe a total of 4 pages, maybe, with the Commodore's wife, the Commodora. Pretty sure she doesn't even get a name.
The Commodora.
The Commodore. whose role in the book is to bitch at her husband until he gives her pretty things.
Yes, she acts like a standard shrewish character. I think we're supposed to think that it's a little politically motivated.
Well, yeah, she says, you know, like, her dad obviously has power, because she says, my father won't be happy with this, and we're looking out for the good of these other places, but ultimately, she has no personality, her purpose is to be a bitch.
Yep.
And that's it. No emotional connection to her whatsoever. I'm pretty sure until you see her and the servant girl, they don't even mention, like, women or girls or her or she, like, at all.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure you're right. Maybe, like, someone mentioned they had a female relative somewhere.
Yeah.
But they certainly didn't get a name.
But I'm pretty sure Mallow's like, oh, you know, just get a young girl. Any girl will do. And I'm like, oh, there's the word girl on the page for probably the first time in this book.
I have to admit that I didn't really think about it until Gab said something, but then it was immediately so blatantly obvious.
Yeah. I don't always want to be that person, but seriously, can you give me, like, one female character?
Yeah, right? I was actually feeling so proud of myself, too, because I was watching a movie the other day, and the movie was annoying me because the women in it were such weak characters. And I was like, oh, I'm getting better at this. And then I get a text from her the very next morning. This book has no female characters in it. I'm like, shit, it doesn't.
Oh, no!
I guess I'm not getting better at this.
If you can, admitting it's the first, it's okay.
The first step to not being Eisther. Klazimov.
Yeah, Eisther Klazimov. It's just another example of a male author, I guess, not bothering to acknowledge that the female gender is more fluid than that, exists.
One wonders, why does that happen? I mean, is it because this book was written in the 1950s and it's about politics and economics and power plays?
But if it's based on the fall of the Roman Empire, shouldn't there be, like, one overbearing mother figure in there or something?
If he read Gibbon, come on. Maybe he didn't read all of it. Maybe he just read the title.
Because the Romans loved their, like,
their evil stepmother figures.
Yeah,
they
loved that crap. You'd think there'd be one in there.
My theory is that Terminus just doesn't have any women on it.
Yeah, that's what Ben told me. The future doesn't have any women. So I decided everyone born into the Foundation is a butt baby.
That's one of their technologies that no one else has.
They get to poop out kids.
That's why the Commodore has a wife, because they have to be able to make more kids to extend the line, but the Foundation doesn't care.
Honestly, if you look at it from that perspective, all the close male friendships start looking pretty fishy.
There you go.
This book is actually 100% LGBT friendly.
If only Asimov was still alive.
What if you brought that interpretation to him? So everyone in Terminus is a guy, right? So they're all in gay relationships. He'd be like, what?
I wonder if he'd be confused. He'd probably be a little confused. I had to think that he would just laugh.
Yeah.
Without knowing anything about the man's personality. Well, I had to think he'd just throw his head back and laugh. Go, like, you crazy kids these days.
Oh, fans. You guys are hilarious.
That's right. I ship Harden. I write Harden / Lee fiction.
That's who I would write it about if I was going to write it about someone. I guess you could write, like, hate / between Mallow and Set.
There you go. That would be the next most popular pairing.
Yeah, guys, if you ever think that anything is sacred, go to fanfiction.net and look for Bible fanfiction. Most popular pairing, as far as I can tell, is Jesus Judas. Read and enjoy your day. It's the most fantastic thing I've ever seen.
Praise / fix.
Oh, yeah. Fandom is the best. Yes, I love it.
All right, so getting back on track away from / fan fiction, you know, assuming that that is not on track for you. It might be.
You
I don't
can
know.
Never get away from slash.
It's impossible to avoid.
People are slashing you, Caleb, at this very instant.
No, but only because Caleb hasn't been on the podcast. We'll probably some Ben / Tony.
Oh, yeah.
And probably some Ben / Gab.
No, don't say it! Because
that's how fandom works.
No, fandom, don't do it. You are horrible people. I changed my mind. Go back to your Jesus Judas stories.
That's right.
Leave us be.
The Hobermallow arc also is where the Foundation starts going away a little bit from religion as their primary state policy and into economics as their primary state policy.
Yeah, so under Hardin, he actually managed to get through the second crisis by using people's belief in the religion to overthrow any chance of a rebellion against them.
Yeah, rigs up, what the hell? He rigs up that's probably the word I mixed up. Okay, tangent. He rigs up this relay with the Anacreonian fleet and has one of their priests come on the air and curse everything, and he flips the switch and all the power in the kingdom goes dead.
Yep.
And the people, well, somewhat predictably, flip a shit.
Yeah, and all the other priests are in on it, too, so they've been preaching to everyone that this is going to happen, you're going to lose your soul, etc., etc.
And then there's the proof, and bend the knee.
Yep.
So under Mallow, it's less religion. In fact, he gets rid of religion as a cell. That's one of the things he talks about, is that we haven't successfully taken new territory with this in decades, guys. Mm-hmm. We need a new system. And so instead, they start just selling their stuff to everybody and creating these economic spheres of influence. The historical comparison I was thinking of, and this is probably not very exact, but is the Phoenicians, if you want to think ancient Roman times again, where they were trading. They had lots of territory where they had influence, where they were able to sell their stuff. And when they actually had to go to war, they had to hire an army, because they didn't actually have one of their own.
Uh-huh.
That would be barbarous.
Barbarous.
Barbarous. Simply barbarous.
Yeah, but you have this this idea that once, like, the religion erodes, you now have the rise of capitalism, I guess?
Yeah,
trade?
I wanted to compare it a little bit to colonial Europe as well, just in terms of outclassing everyone, except that they weren't so much selling their stuff to places and bringing them into the fold, they were taking all of their stuff and then killing their people.
So you mean like with the Indians or the Native Americans?
Yeah, so it doesn't quite work all the way, but like that, you know, just having economic spheres of influence like the East India Company,
mm-hmm.
which actually had as much power as, and more power than a lot of states did at
uh-huh.
the time. And, I mean, historically, it has worked.
Yeah. And I did like Hardin's comment, because someone said, well, you know, we can't do this forever. And he's like, well, you know, I figured out what people valued once they stopped valuing religion, money. And some guy in the future will figure out what people value once money becomes obsolete. So, whatever.
It'll get taken care of when the time comes.
I liked that ending. But you do have this overarching theme between Hardin and Mallow of avoiding the conflict.
Yeah, why fight when you don't have to fight? And actually, Hardin has a phrase that he uses numerous times
mm-hmm.
and is one of my favorite quotes of all time, actually, and it's that violence is the last refuge of the incompetent. It's like, come on, you can find a better way.
Yeah. I loved that, too, actually. There is that, it's almost a pacifist thread running through the book.
Yeah, a little bit, yeah. They're still trying to, let's see, what's the word that I use? They're still trying to project their power. They're just not doing it by wheeling a battleship into the harbor and saying, so, maybe you do want to lease us that territory for that canal.
Mm-hmm. They do it in a trickier way.
Yes.
Let me give you the atomic power to run that dam, and I'll station some priests there to
make
sure it runs. And
here's something the size of a fountain pen that can replace all of the machinery in your steel foundry. Well, that's pretty handy.
That's cool.
I want three. For no reason.
I want three.
I'm going to wear them as Wolverine claws.
What if Wolverine had atomic pen claws? X-Men would be...
It would be a very different series.
Pretty amazing. So, that's a lot of the major threads running for throughout the book. There is one little one that I really liked that Ben and I referenced earlier when we were saying Balbois.
Yes.
We have an Imperial envoy who goes and visits the Foundation. And I guess his diplomatic thing he's decided that makes him classy is to not pronounce his R's. Because they said when he gets really excited about something, he kind of forgets and slips up.
And occasionally starts pronouncing his R's, right?
So he, for some reason, decides that the classy way to talk is not using your R's.
I think he's just putting on a very affected accent.
He's like a person from the capital.
I was totally about to say that. And so he's sitting there like, Harden, it's simply barbarous out here on the periphery.
Which, sometimes I'd read his dialogue and be like, what?
Yeah, I know.
Just, like, take a second.
It's like, well, it sounds like either baby talk or, like, you're missing your teeth.
Or you're the guy from The Princess Bride.
I don't know where the sophistication comes in. Yeah, exactly. Like, it's not sophisticated
marriage
at all. Marriage
is what brings us here together.
With all
to
these...
die.
With these barbarous powerfulies.
But the thing this... I mean, it was funny because he did that, but then he was actually a pretty intelligent guy. But then... there's this little commentary on academics, and he says, oh, you know, I found all these classic minds who've been talking about maybe where we come from, because as Ben and I mentioned, they don't even remember Earth exists anymore. You know, some people speculate it's here, here, or here, so I'm going to read up on them, and I'm going to figure out who's right. And Harden says, well, why don't you just go to those planets and look for evidence on them to see which one used to have people on it? And he's like, why would I do that? I already have the opinions of the leading scholars. I don't need to go check it out for myself.
I'll just weigh their opinions and see whose is heaviest.
Yeah, arguments the most compelling. And I just cracked up at that because that's totally a thing.
Right.
Like in ancient Greece or Rome, like, you give the most eloquent speech, you win, even if your point's not as strong.
Well, why don't you go make direct observations and collect evidence yourself? That's not how science works, you silly mayor.
What's wrong with you?
What's wrong with you?
What's wrong with you?
Harden.
He's like, what?
And Harden goes... okay.
It's like, oh yeah, people don't know how to think anymore. Okay.
So one of my favorite scenes in the book actually comes after the envoy leaves and Harden shows up in front of the city council, and which is what they call their government of their whole planet and empire, actually.
City council.
Yes, the mayor and his council. He shows up and he says, so I just ran a semantic analysis with, you know, our pet linguist. And... took all the statements and translated them into symbolic logic, and it turns out that huge document that Anacreon just sent us says, give us what we want or we'll kill you, and every single statement that envoy made during his 2-week stay cancel each other out.
Yeah, he said absolutely nothing.
He said nothing. There was zero content in everything he said for 2 weeks. The guy's actually kind of a genius.
Yeah, actually.
He presents it that way. He's like, come on, you kind of have to, like, grudgingly respect that. He's actually a pretty good diplomat.
That's diplomacy to an amazing level.
Ideally, you want your diplomats to be able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And he did it. He obviously did a great job, because when he left, the rest of the council felt...
That they would be protected.
Yes, they felt quite good about themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Again, without that one smart guy to figure stuff out, everyone would have kind of been screwed. And apparently Selden could predict that would happen.
Oh no, the Empire's totally going to help us. He was really nice to us. He never said that, guys.
Yeah, he never said anything. He just babbled about Baoboism.
Baoboism. For like... archaeology.
What the hell?
Also, there was a guy named Weenus.
Seriously, like, spelled exactly like Wiener, basically, but with an S instead of an R. Weenus. Why?
I said, you'd never get away with naming someone Weenus in a story today. Unless it was a college comedy, maybe. Yeah. But
also, there was a guy with the last name Sut, and I totally read it as slut, like, 90% of the time. So...
Because we are mature.
Yeah, apparently wieners and sluts, guys. That's what you can expect from the Novel Ideas podcast.
The kind of sophistication you've come to expect from our literary analysis.
Our professional demeanor. Well, I don't know. Anything else to say, or you want to do wrap up?
I kind of want to say weenus again.
God.
But I'm good to go now.
What are the strengths and weaknesses of the writing?
You know, it's pretty easy to read. It's a heck of a lot easier to get through than the Scarlet Letter.
Well, that's true.
There's probably less description in this whole book than in an average Hawthorne paragraph.
Which is neither a good nor a bad thing.
Asimov actually gets criticized a little bit sometimes for writing pretty flatly. Some of the short stories I've read, that's definitely more true than in this book. The part of that I'll agree with is that it's not a very human tale. This Foundation is a very historical type of tale.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, it's not boring. It doesn't really, it shouldn't really bother you, I think.
I was going to say, it's interesting what's right. going on, but you're not going to walk away... feeling connected to the characters at all. And if you're like me, I mean, I couldn't help but get hung up on the fact that there were no women whatsoever.
And quite so fairly, I would say.
That the kind of dampened things for me, too.
And then, you know, when we were talking about Childhood's End and Arthur C. Clarke,
uh-huh.
I brought up the idea of there are, in science fiction, there are some authors who are definitely more... ideas over execution. And I think Asimov probably falls into that category, though not as hard as Arthur C. Clarke.
Yeah. So
if Clarke's 80-20, then Asimov is like 55-45. Because there are moments. And then as he, if you've read some of his other work, the robot stories actually are a good example of tales that are more human, oddly enough.
Robots!
But you actually get to know some of the characters a little bit more, and there are some more feelings, and not just as much as, holy shit, we're in the future! This is awesome!
Yeah. And that would be my main criticism of the book. I liked it pretty well. I thought it was interesting, but I wouldn't, like, run around recommending it to people who weren't science fiction fans. Like, my friends who just like to read literature, I don't know if I would ever say, go pick up Foundation.
I tend to agree, actually. I would point, you know, if I was going to point a science fiction novel at a literary type person, there's a lot of stuff I would choose before I went into the Asimov, Clark, well, probably even Heinlein, much as I love him.
And those are the three science fiction authors we've read.
I know. Well, they're kind of the guys, they're like the historical background, almost, for the genre, you know? In Heinlein, actually, I think you could be a literary person and like some of his stories.
Mm-hmm.
Stranger in a Strange Land. Uh-huh. Or, you know, Moon is a Harsh Mistress for the politically inclined. Whereas Asimov is more Robots and Empires.
Yeah.
And Clark is more computers and weird aliens.
Children becoming and, hive mind.
Yeah, and big idea concept pictures. So, anyway.
So, overall, it's good. Like we said, if you're a science fiction fan, it's probably a good idea to pick up some Asimov to kind of see the beginnings, some of the beginnings of the genre. Like we were talking about, some of those religious and economic threads are pretty interesting. If you wanted to read it just to purely rage about the fact there are no women, any of those reasons could be a compelling reason to read it.
It's a short 200 pages.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it is exactly 200 pages long.
So if you want to read it for any of those reasons, do it. You'll be done quickly.
Mm-hmm. It takes a couple days, so. Yeah. I guess that's pretty much all we have to say about Foundation. Oh, no, there was one question that I had. We only get about 150 years into it and out of the 1,000 years, and I wanted to know, how does the Foundation help end the barbarism and bring back civilization?
Yeah, and specifically, I kind of wonder what the crisis is at the 1,000-year mark that causes the galaxy to become unified.
Mm-hmm.
That must be kind of interesting.
Yeah. Big idea. Maybe that's why we never got around to it.
Yeah, because he did write sequels, and he does get a few hundred years farther into it, but once you get past the original trilogy, and it's no longer a trilogy anymore, those books have a very different flavor. And they don't feel like they're part... I've read all of them, by the way. they don't feel like they're part of the same thing to me. And I think a fair amount of the fandom for Foundation would probably agree with that. I think there are a lot of people who don't much care for those. So I guess, what are you reading now?
I'm reading all the same stuff I was reading before.
Ah, history nerdage.
Yeah.
Well, that's what happens when you read, like, 7 things at the same time,
too. Yeah, I'm, like, halfway through, like, 5 books.
I'm actually, as long as I'm rereading Foundation, I just went ahead and picked up Foundation and Empire when I finished, because I was trying to get the timeline straight in my head, so I've actually almost finished that now. And then I have a stack of graphic novels that I'm going to get to after that, so... This should be fun.
Yeah.
We'll work a graphic novel into a rotation.
Oh, definitely.
Some point. Yeah.
Well, I obviously Watchmen.
Watchmen's on the list, guys.
At some point. So don't like flood our inbox with Watchmen.
I mean, you could. That would mean we'd have to do it sooner, so. Actually, that's probably a good idea if you want to hear it. So, I guess, if you want to flood our inbox with requests for Watchmen...
Yeah, how do you do that? Well, you can email us at novelideaspodcast@gmail.com.
You can hit us on Twitter at novelideaspod.
If you're getting us... Well, I guess if you're getting us through iTunes, we have a website, www.novelideaspodcast.com. And if you're getting us through the website... We are also on iTunes.
And you can go leave a comment or a review, or you can even subscribe there.
You totally can subscribe there.
Yeah, and you should subscribe
there. We have no idea how many subscribers we have. I think we have like 6 reviews on iTunes, but our webpage doesn't tell us any of our hits from iTunes. So
yeah, ratings, reviews, and subscriptions are good things. And I guess... That is virtually the end. What are we reading next week? I better say that so you don't stop me mercilessly.
Next week, we are reading Love in the Time of Cholera by Gabriel Garcia Marquez. He's a very well-known Hispanic... Well, he's not from Spain, so I was just rude. I don't actually remember what country he's from, so that's Latin. Maybe ruder.
Latinish.
But he's a very well-known author. People read his stuff in school a lot. I've read a pretty fair amount of his novels. I think the translations are beautiful, so I imagine that the original Spanish is amazing. Unfortunately, I can neither read nor speak Spanish.
If anyone's read it in the original Spanish and wants to comment on the prose, feel free.
Yeah.
We'd love to know, actually.
Yeah. So we'll be covering that, a little bit of heavy material, and... After that, we are actually planning on a 3 or 4 week New York Times bestseller extravaganza.
Yeah, we haven't figured out exactly which ones yet, but there'll probably be some stuff in there that just on the surface of it leaves a bad taste in my mouth.
So feel free to comment on any really popular stuff from the last year you'd like us to read.
Yep, it needs to be something that was probably in the top 5 or 10 for more than 1 week and in the last year.
Yep.
And we'll read it.
Yep.
And hopefully not hate it.
Hopefully.
We'll see. So that's all for this time. And I guess we'll see you next week.
Yeah, bye.